I'm here in Dundee Contemporary Arts with Roddy Buchanan on the day of the opening of his show Players. So, Roddy, can you tell me a bit about the work in the exhibition, especially Out, the 35mm film that was commissioned by DCA?
You know, Dundee were very supportive right from the beginning, and Katrina in particular really wanted to make that work. I had tried to make it, you know, 2 or 3 years ago down in London, and I got a skater. He's a really funny guy. He worked in a really high-powered office block in the centre of London, and I had to go and visit him in this office and had his suit. It was also a plush office, but I had a massive Moto Guzzi monster motorcycle in the office. So he was my skater, and everything was fine until about 2 days before the shoot, when the guy who was in charge of the car park told me that, you know, I had to have £1 million public indemnity insurance to get the job done. But I suppose it was worth waiting for, because the production values and everything were much higher, and this building had suggested itself because it looks a wee bit like an East Coast Guggenheim. Well, East Coast of Scotland Guggenheim. It's got a really beautiful big curves and stuff. And one of the reasons to do it on film was because I'd been sort of jealous of seeing other people's films over the last wee while at the kind of detail. I saw last year Sharon Lockhart's Gosha Gorka. It's absolutely beautiful. I love it. And they were bouncing these sort of basketballs, and you could see the flesh tremble on the arm. And I was just fascinated with that level of resolution, which on video, you know, your mind is having to make up like 30% of the stuff because it's so pixelated. So the car park, which is all sort of concrete and has really nice staining, you know, you'd lose all that with video. I mean, film can record dim spaces much better also, and you were able to adjust it in the way that you can, you know, do with photography as and grade it so that you could make it brighter and stuff, which in video, again, it's more tricky to do that sort of thing. Of course, there's advantages and disadvantages with Peloton. That's really, you know, essential. In fact, the screen is close up to you so that you really are getting lost inside the image, and the colours also pumped up on the projection so that it does that video effect where they start to mesh, particularly with reds and yellows. I mean, there's all sorts of layers of that going on, because every, you know, with some projects, of course, it's important to keep the distance between start and finish, you know, really narrow, but that's gone so many levels of self-production, in the sense, like, you know, it's recorded on the ground but via, you know, a helicopter, so you've got this kind of breakup that's happening, you know, regularly.
Maybe
in the film. Yeah, so Peloton is like a distillation of about 75 hours of the Tour de France in 1998. I've watched that tour, I think, like 4 or 5 times now.
That's about a week of your life.
Yeah, it was a week well spent. It went through kind of very simple processes. First of all, eliminating all the starts and finishes, and then taking out...
What do you mean, eliminating?
Well, obviously the tour, the whole coverage of the tour has the guys, you know, holding the trophy at the end of the day, getting them presented with the yellow jersey, all that's cut out. The Peloton, which is just the main pack, the lead pack, and having watched cycling now for a wee while, it was kind of a moment of realisation, just like with anything that you watch or whatever, you sort of gain an understanding. You know, it's never identified who's in the Peloton. There's never personalities in that Peloton. It's the lead group, and they do work as a unit, almost like Christine's jellyfish. They help each other along, and, you know, the front is ever-changing, but it's never like so-and-so's at the front of the Peloton. That's of no importance. But, of course, what is important are the guys at the back and at the front, you know, who are trying to escape the Peloton. They decide to make it their day, and they're cycling off, and the Peloton... just because it's kind of unstoppable, and it's made up of so much kind of like fresh blood that you can never defeat the Peloton. The Peloton moves through the landscape at a constant pace. And if so, you sprint away, and it's all the day is made up of the Peloton chasing you, and is it going to chase you down? And 99 out of 100 times, the Peloton gobbles up the sprinters. So you've been watching this thing for like 6 hours, and these guys have been like heroic effort going up the Alps or whatever, and then like within 3 k's of the end, the Peloton just comes through, and it's on TV it's so, you know, it seems so tragic, but the cyclists, I mean, there's just no emotion except from, I mean, the guys who are losing out, you see them, because you never join the peloton again. What happens is the peloton just like rushes through you, just goes, and you know, the guy drops way off the back and that's it. His energy levels just, you know, like sank right down. So he's like totally out of batteries. He's done like 100 or 150 Ks and, you know, in this kind of group, they're just moving constantly through the pace, just go right through them. You never get the story of the individual, it's purely the story of the group. But then another layer of editing was like the way the camera comes in close or goes away very far away, pulls out. I count all those shots, you know, when it comes too close where you could identify people or pans out too far that you can't really see what's going on. So it's all mid shots, it's all aerial shots, it's only the aerial shots, all the text elements that are thrown up at in these programs, that's all eliminated. So what you're left with is 4 hours in terms of the way it operates in the gallery. You know, you come in the morning and you're going through you know, Normandy, you come in at lunchtime, you're going through the Alps, and you come in the early afternoon and that's you going up the Champs-Élysées. It's like this ever-changing sort of like Gainsborough or Turner landscape.
I was thinking that it was quite like migrating birds or something, you know, this kind of swarm has any function other than to be a unit of the group, which will relentlessly cross borders until it reaches its destination.
I mean, it tunes into something that's very sort of popular within popular science. You know, like this building across here, Sensation, is all about popularising science. And one of the big things, I don't know, that's caught people's imagination in the last few years has been this idea of the superorganism and the idea of that's how this, you know, this group operates. As you say, you know, it looks like a swarm, or it looks like, you know, herding cattle. But of course, the golden gems in the whole, you know, as you're watching it, is when they hit a roundabout. They scatter the same way as, like, you know, if a shark or a seal goes into a shoal of fish, they all go. They seem to be moving, and all of a sudden they go. Well, that's what happens when this thing hits a roundabout. They all shh and come back again. It's quite
like Mercury.
Yeah, totally.
So maybe just describe what it is.
The title of the piece is Chasing 1,000, and it's two guys trying to head the ball 1,000 times consecutively, and it sort of follows their attempt. There's a counter up in the right-hand corner that just ticks over every time they head the ball, and you sort of get caught up in the kind of mini-drama that's going on until the ball drops. Now, the evolution of this work was interesting that years ago, the art school took a DAAD tour of northern Germany around all the museums and institutions. As we're visiting these places, the whole group, a bit like Peloton, people had different paces for getting through a gallery. And Paul and I were very fast at getting through a gallery, you know, kind of see what you want to see and come out again. And so you had to wait until everybody came out of the gallery. Somebody had the bright idea to bring along a football, and this is what we did while we waited for people to all congregate again. I mean, again, it was made specifically, like all the work in the show, pretty much every single one of them was made for a specific institution or a specific time and place. This was an invite to do a show in New York, and it was just prior to the World Cup in 94, so I wanted to make something that was somehow the most New York-y piece of work, but communicated something about, you know, the difference between Europeans and Americans. You know, if you throw a ball to an American, he'll start bouncing it around or slam dunk it. And if you throw a ball to a European, he'll either kick it back to you or head it back to you. But the motif, which, getting back to, I guess, the formal aspect of a lot of the work, is that you sort of recognise what's going on within the first moments. And although the story is always changing and it can hold your attention for a good long period of time, if that's the sort of time you want to dedicate to it, you understand it and can go away and sort of piece the work together.
So, hi, should we walk around the show then and discuss?
Yeah. Well, in fact, the first work's right up at the top of the foyer space as you walk in. You know, I've been working on this exhibition, or at least sort of negotiating it with Katrina and Andrew since the building was, you know, founded. So
really? Wow.
Yeah.
So, you know, when's that, 2 years ago or something?
So I was invited up when you know it was just at its foundations, it was a sort of empty shell. And in fact, at the beginning and at the end of the exhibition, you know, that's sort of hopefully apparent, that sort of level of research. You know, the commission, which is called Out and works with a skater, was because, or part of the motivation for doing it was that this had formerly been a skate park where this building is now. So that was why Katrina was very keen on taking that idea and presenting it here. This other piece, I've made over a series, over a period of time, a whole set of sort of works that I suppose have a relationship with architecture. And this long corridor was always sort of blank. I've actually now just put up a cinema's listening piece of vinyl, which is a bit of annoying, but as you come in the space, you've got this, you know, text that I suppose, you know, you walk down, and it's a very simple sort of strategy. As you read the text, the geography of the space or the architecture mimics the move that's being talked about in the reportage. So it's a slice, and the building, Dundee Contemporary Arts, dog legs round in the same way as...
Did you read the text?
Yes, yeah, certainly. His ball hard up against the tree, he risked all, including wrists and club, by taking aim with his six iron and closing his eyes on impact. He bounded after the shot to watch it slice mightily, bending over 50 yards onto the green. And that was Sergio Garcia back in 1999. This was a very famous shot. You know, he employed this trick shot to land it on the penultimate hole in the US PGA Masters in 1999. It's probably physically the biggest piece in the show. You know, the kind of glue that the whole exhibition works around is this piece, 10 in a Million. You know, in the 90s when, you know, I first was sort of like loose on the scene, there was so much opportunity to travel. People had so limited budgets, but air flights were so cheap that our generation were allowed to run riot all over Europe. So somehow to make use of that, you know, work with these diverse geographic locations, I chose a single sort of strategy, you know, one particular viewpoint to then go out and make these portraits of cities. 10 in a Million works on the principle, you go to the centre spot of a football field and let the camera run on this sort of slow panning device, and it goes round twice and you get to look at the landscape. The screen sort of splits. You know, you've got these kind of constants, like the halfway up the screen, the bottom half is either always green or always red or always black, depending on what's there. And above, it's kind of funny, it kind of goes in and out of sort of your recognition. All the same motifs come up, like generic sports centre, you know, with no windows that the kids can smash, sort of architecture, railway lines, tree planting. In terms of city planning, these pictures always turn out to be in the same sorts of places. So half the time you're thinking, God, that could be, you know, I wonder where that is, that could be anywhere. And then all of a sudden something, you know, throws itself up that identifies it very, very clearly.
Maybe this is in a lot of works, yeah. Global and local.
Yeah. Well, I always wondered, when I started this work, and I suppose a lot of the projects are the same, part of the motivation is that at what point did football become this all-consuming world activity? You know, I'm sure 50 years ago you couldn't make this work. It's something that's just now football has become so internationally accepted. And I was talking to these guys who had been part of the Tiananmen Square uprising, and they were talking that they had gone to a special school in China for soccer. You know, it's like, I mean, at what point did China decide they were going to throw themselves in with FIFA? You know, it's kind of weird. So Simon Starling actually goes out in his journeys and has sent back quite a few good photographs, like in the Peruvian mountains, up there in the Andes, you know, these kind of improvised football fields, or out in the deserts and, you know, in Mexico, you know, and all the stones have cleared and people have made. It's almost like, you know, the drawings at Machu Picchu or something like that. You know, it's these things that if there was an atomic bomb, people would wonder what these sort of drawings are in the landscape, because the lines, as you say, are ever-present. And just because of the way the camera runs, the centre circle has this white line that just runs like an inch from the bottom of the screen. So it's a sol de wit for everyone.
So we've come into the first room and we see a collection of photographs of young lads who look to me like they're probably from Glasgow, but they could be from anywhere, all wearing branded sports kit. cat.
Yeah. When I was living in America, first of all, I had this project called Yankees, where I came back from America and started to see people wearing Yankees baseball caps in Amsterdam and Paris, Berlin. So I took a set of photographs, and from that, a whole series sort of evolved, where it was this kind of multinational supporters club. People were using it for different reasons, you know, like a lot of the sort of like Turks in Berlin were thrown in their lot with the American crowd. It was a sort of a positive association for them. They were sort of colour. You know, the folk in New York, I guess, they viewed as being sort of an empowered community. There was all those sort of things going on. And they were all in the city centre, all people approximately our age. That's who you see in the city centre. Then when I came back from you know, New York, and ended up living in Denison, out in a sort of residential part of Glasgow, the demographics totally drop, and all the people on the street are like 12 to 18. And then I noticed, of course, that this was, you know, not only were people wearing Yankees, they were just wearing all these different, you know, American club caps.
All these photographs are taken in Denison?
Within a square mile of where I live. And then, you know, over a period of like 4 years, I've just gone out, you know, maybe, you know, every couple of months, and taken a set of photographs. When I came back, that the people who were wearing this, it was like everywhere. It's starting to sort of tail off, and you're getting the, you know, it's really only the really committed cap wearers that are now out there. It started off as a big fashion thing a few years ago, and now it's like really hardcore. As I say, in Denison, it's like it's a sort of semi-gang thing. The guys would say to me, you know, Roddy, you've got to be able to handle yourself. You wear a cap round here, you know. There was all sorts of subtext. If you wear a cap in this sort of like area or in any of these suburban areas, you know, you're putting your hand up as a sort of wise guy, and so you're being seen in the street, and you're seeing other people. It's a sort of symbol. I mean, that didn't apply to everybody by any means, but there was all sorts of coded messaging going on. It's like, the Toronto Maple Leafs are sponsored by Nike, Rangers Football Club are sponsored by Nike, it's a blue colour, so that was possible. You know, the Celtic guy up there is like Michigan, which is a sort of Irish state, you know, and Illinois and all that. The show is pinned either end with these two big photographic projects. This was made back in 1995. It's called Work in Progress. Coast to Coast, which is at the other end, is ongoing, still making that work. 39 photographs in one, 45 in the other. And this was, again, a notion of how do you make your... I wanted to see if you brought a collection of people together, whether they would look Glaswegian. It was round about the time that ethnic cleansing had sort of first been coined in the press, and I kind of wanted to see whether people, you know, was there a kind of look to the city? I mean, in Glasgow, there's this ongoing myth about, you know, being able to recognise Catholics from Protestants. Mm-hmm. So I just set up this kind of strategy which allowed me to look at that. I mean, the text that runs with it says, players who associate themselves with Italian football by wearing Inter Milan and AC Milan shirts amid the dozens of local tops on display every night on the football parks of Glasgow. If you can imagine, these guys are next to guys who are wearing Manchester United, Liverpool, all these kind of clubs, and they've chosen to throw the lot in with the Milan. At the time this was made, these were the two biggest clubs in the world. I kind of came to the conclusion with this that, of course, there was a number of them did have their Italian fantasy and felt that they looked a wee bit Italian and were sort of advertising it to their friends, you know. So after you look at it for a wee moment, you start to realise maybe they're a wee bit too old, they're a wee bit too fat, they're a wee bit too ugly to be professional athletes. And, you know, I asked them to stand in a certain way.
Yeah.
It was to give them that sort of uniform studio, but also the way that new players at a club get photographed and sent out as a press release sort of mimics that whole subculture. You know, there was a nice dynamic too in taking the photographs that I was the paparazzi to their sort of fantasy of being a football star. So it sort of worked, you know, for both of us. You know, I was able to get something and they totally felt like they got something in return.
Yeah, yeah.
So the, you know, as again, in reference to, I suppose, the history of of my generation of artists. You know, it's been such a long time of just doing like group show after group show after group show, like 12 a year for the last like fucking 5-6 years. And the opportunity to present more than two pieces of work just hardly ever arises. So this was an opportunity, you know, even for you know, my friends to see a lot of the projects that have been you know, done over the last while, and see if there is a sort of relationship.
I'm here with Mark Quinn in his studio to talk about two shows you've had recently. One's currently on at the moment at the V&A, and also your show at White Cube Gallery. But I'd like to first of all start by asking you really about your practice in terms of how you initially were engaging with your body. That's changed a little in the White Cube show, but could we start by talking about self?
Yeah. I suppose I wanted to just start from a kind of ground zero, and I wanted to make sculptures that were not modelled but were casts, so they're like a kind of photograph, three-dimensional photograph. And I wanted to start with myself because I thought at that time if you use someone else then it implies a relationship, and the question is, you know, why are you using that person and not another? And there's a whole other side to it which I didn't want to engage with at that time. So I just wanted to use myself as the kind of neutral model.
Now, obviously, for various reasons, not least because of sensation, that particular work, because of the blood, because of your whole engagement with the work, became quite a celebrated piece of work. Do you find that, with hindsight now, kind of a little irritating that you are still, you know, when you read editorial about your work, it's still very much associated with that piece, although now, of course, people are much more engaging with your most recent
works. Well, I think that people can only engage with what they know, and I don't find it irritating, and I think that that piece is one that's most famous in Britain, whereas, you know, in Italy, where I did the Frozen Garden at Prada, that's probably what people would talk about. And I think that, you know, there's a difference between looking at something in a catalogue and actually experiencing it in real life. And, you know, I'm sure if the garden was shown here, people would talk about that. But in a way, it's great to be able to make a piece that still people talk about 10 years later, you know.
As you've mentioned the garden, perhaps we could talk about that. Because here in England, we didn't see the garden. What we saw was a very interesting reference to that in your artworks, which were in fact the permaprints.
That's right.
So I'd like to talk about, first of all, the garden, the whole idea behind it.
Yeah.
This wonderful idea of this kind of preserved Garden of Eden. And then the way you took that into another dialogue with photography itself.
Well, in a way, the garden come from the frozen flower sculptures, which come from the idea of making another kind of frozen work, but the opposite of self. Something that, or not ostensibly the opposite, something that's not gory, that's beautiful and almost just kind of light, neutral, beautiful, life enhancing. But in fact, the irony, of course, is that all the plants are dead. So they appear to live forever, but in order for that to happen, they die. And the other irony, which is quite interesting, is that if you turn the freezer off and they start to rot, that's when life actually comes back, because the life of the bacteria eating them up. So in a funny way, when they look alive is when they're least alive, and when they look least alive is when they're most alive. Yeah, that's a bit of a tangent, but so I made these frozen flower sculptures, and there's sort of bunches of flowers and things. But I wanted to do this big project. I had an idea to do a whole garden, a whole kind of Garden of Eden that's and obviously it seemed like an impossible project, but I was talking to Prada Foundation about it, and then they kind of said, let's do it, which was fantastic.
You also took the flowers from different continents, yeah, and different places.
In effect, the whole garden is about desire in its purest form, because I just got a plant catalogue and didn't know anything about plants, fit through it, chose ones I liked and ordered them, and they all arrived in Milan on the same day, and I put them into, and then planted them into the turf and lowered it and froze it in the thing. I mean, it's a bit more complicated than that, but it was about, in a way, the way that nature's also kind of been changed by the whole commodification, and the fact that you can order, you know, the commerce in nature, in a sense. And so even something that which is supposed to be natural is not natural. It says about what's natural and what's not natural as well.
So selecting, you would choose them because they were a wonderful shape or a wonderful colour, but again, as you say, it's...
They could never all grow... It's a bit like a vegetable last judgment, because they could never all grow together at the same time, and be in bloom at the same time and all that.
Now, you also used mirrors in the piece. So quite a lot was written about how you could both... You could kind of almost be in the piece.
Exactly. You can see yourself in the piece, but you can never actually be there. So it's about the impossibility of being in two places at the same time, and the difference between image and self-consciousness, in a sense, or your bodily sense of yourself. And so it's about our relation to image as well, and how the image is something that we kind of... Well, it's that question, are you captured by an image, or do you capture an image, kind of thing? And the idea that image in a mirror is a manifestation of the whole way that we know ourselves, from the reflections we get from other people, in the sense of talking to people, that your whole self is a creation of reflection, whether it's literal or in other ways.
And you take that idea or that metaphor even further with the work, because you then photographed it and used that as a basis for your works.
Exactly, so it's taking it to another, it was freezing. I mean, the other thing that's interesting to me about colour is that colour in photography is, it's impossible to make, or it was impossible to make a permanent colour image. And, you know, even Cibachromes last maybe 50 years, a C-print will last probably 20 years. And so this idea that colour is this fugitive element. And then I was talking to a friend of mine who's spends his whole time working on this issue, and in fact there is a colour process from the 30s called a pigment transfer print, where you take a colour image, you turn it into three different colour screens, and you put down pigment, and so then you get a permanent image which lasts, but you can only make them very small. But recent advances of technology that he's been kept up with has meant that you can now do this on a larger scale, and you could do it on any surface, on canvas. So I thought I'd do it on canvas, and then you have the kind of ironic relationship to painting and photography. You know, is pigment on canvas, is it a painting or is it a photograph? And the kind of most banal artwork is the flower painting. So it's a kind of reference to that as well.
I love that. I loved all the different references, the way it references the frozen moment in photography, and it's literally the frozen moment, and as you say,
it's like a hall of mirrors, it's the frozen, and you lose, it's taking it by abstracting it to another level. But it's also about unattainable perfection, in the sense that you see this garden, and there's something slightly uncanny about it, because it's perfectly still. And it's also, the silicon has the effect of, has different refractive index to water or to air, and it intensifies the colours of the plant. So it seems hyper-real. So you're very close to this kind of perfection. You can almost touch it, but you can never actually be in it. So it's all about the impossibility of being perfect as well.
Your work engages both with history of art, which you studied at Cambridge, but also with ideas of science, alchemy, really fundamental issues to do with life. What was your drive to be so interested originally in the kind of the materials you use? Well, I mean, you do use such a variety of materials
well,
in your work.
That, sculpture is about material in one big aspect. It's about two things, form and material, I suppose. And in a way, if you're an artist, you transform material in some way. That's one of the things I like about the frozen flower sculptures. They appear to be untransformed, but in fact they're utterly transformed. And so it's kind of using the language of material and transformation to be part of the work as well. The material has a meaning in a sense. In modernist art, the material is irrelevant. It's just architecture for form. And you know, you make a bronze sculpture, or maybe marble, or whatever. But it wasn't really about the history of the material or using that as part of the meaning of the work. And then it's, I suppose, you look at someone like Boyce, where it's kind of rectifies that, and you're using the material. He's using the material for its metaphoric qualities, and I think it's kind of from that kind of work that, kind of in a way, made me want to use material for its own qualities, but very different kinds of material to what he would use.
Yes, and also you've used very different materials for different projects.
Yeah.
For example, you made an ice sculpture of yourself and your girlfriend, which again had that whole thing of impermanence as well as being permanent.
Well, it evaporates away, so it doesn't melt, it evaporates. So, I mean, but that, so you get this sculpture gets smaller and smaller and smaller until it just disappears, and the people in the gallery are breathing in the sculpture. And in a sense, that's interesting because it's a way that once you start working with technology, it feeds itself, because that sculpture came from a problem that there is with the blood sculpture, which is that if you put an object in a chamber that's being cooled by cold air, it'll evaporate the water out of it. So that was a problem. So I had to get over that with the blood sculpture by sealing the surface. But then I thought, well, if it does do that, if your sculpture is all ice, then theoretically it would disappear. And it turned out that was in fact the case. And so then from that problem I turned that into virtue in the other sculpture.
And the series of sculptures you've done quite recently, which I'd like to talk about at some length, with starting with Group, I think it was called.
The Group portrait. The eight portraits of...
With Group, where you took a variety of people that you knew or had come across who had either been injured or had been born with limbs that were somehow not quite formed. Or
I think those eight sculptures are sculptures of people who have lost limbs, either from they've been born without them, or they've lost them in accidents and things like that, or through illness. And in a sense, going back to start with this, maybe you can start in with the idea of the material, using the material. So you've got this idea of marble, which previously is just a neutral, or not, but in the modernist eras is just a kind of banal material for doing sculptures in, because of its certain qualities. But then I wanted to, in a sense, use the weight of history of the material to turn it inside out in some way. In the sense that I was in the British Museum and I was looking at people looking at fragmented sculpture that had been broken, and people were kind of oohing and aahing about it. And I thought, if someone walked in who looked like this sculpture, the same people would react in the opposite way. And so what's that tell you about the difference between art and life? And then I thought, well, why don't I find a disabled person who looks like one of these sculptures and then make a celebratory marble portrait of them? And then you'd be taking all that you know about a fragmented marble sculpture and turning it upside down in a way. And so it kind of started with an intellectual conceit, and then as I got to know the sitters for the sculptures, it just became more and more obvious that this was right for lots of other reasons, and that it was a kind of, you know, that there's no positive images of disability in the history of art. They're always kind of freaks or, and to kind of, so to kind of make these beautiful sculptures, and in a sense marble is material for heroes, and in the classical world a hero is someone who conquers the outside world, but now I think a hero is someone who conquers their inner world, and all these people have conquered their inner worlds, and you know, extremely strong, well-adjusted people now. In a way you could say that these works also relate to the earlier works, because they're about the limits of the relationship of oneself to one's body. You know, if your body is shrinking away in hospital because you've got some terrible disease, your sense of self isn't shrinking with it. And so it's kind of, or is it? You know, and it's that coming to terms. And in fact, what you could say is that all these citizens have come to terms somehow that inside, the outside doesn't read inside. And that's why I think people also have a problem with meeting disabled people or people like this in real life, is because people do read outside as meaning inside. And you know, from Alison Lapper, who's the woman I did the sculpture of in the White Cube show, and you know, I've obviously got to know her, and the things she tells me about the kind of the people basically think, you know, act as if a disabled person is sort of deaf or not there, and talk about them in the third person, and just appalling kind of liberties that no one would dream of taking with someone who's able-bodied. And in fact, you know, what is the difference? It's ridiculous, really, that body image is such a strong thing, and that people misread it so badly.
And now these sculptures are actually in the V&A Museum,
exactly.
Or a selection of them are in the V&A. Again, put amongst, placed amongst classical sculptures.
They're not classical, they're neoclassical sculptures.
Yes.
And I think, but what's interesting about that is that brings out another side to them, which is not the aspect of the fragmentation and loss and why we like an image that seems broken more than we like an image that's whole. Which is another whole area maybe we can talk about. But it brings out the idea of what is beautiful, because you've got in there the Canova's Three Graces and various other sculptures which are all about ideals of beauty. And then you have these sculptures, and it kind of just, you know, it makes you realise what an artificial concept of ideal of beauty is, and yet what a draconian thing that's been going for thousands of years. That, you know, it's almost like people complain about fashion magazines making people feel that their bodies have to conform, but that's really just a continuation of the history of sculpture, you could say.
I'd like to take you back to a point, because I think it's something that engages very much in your work. You did study history of art. And the engagement that you've got with sculpture, particularly with the group series, is very much about the whole idea of this almost worship of something that is incomplete. These statues are incomplete for various reasons.
Yeah.
At what stage were you aware of that when you were studying them originally? I mean,
well,
did you always
really
have a question in your mind, or...?
I didn't really study classical sculpture when I did history of art. I only did at certain periods. I did Dutch, 17th century, and a few other things, but I didn't do that area. But, I mean, I think we don't have to study it. We carry it around with us, you know. And there is that, you know, why is it that the sculpture that is supposed to be the ideal of beauty, like the Venus de Milo, in fact is of a portrait of a woman with no arms, and yet it's, people don't see that, or it's kind of blind. It's this sense of, it's a strange phenomenon, and it's to do also with the idea of it, the broken arms are like, there's this sense of loss, and it comes from a golden time, and the brokenness shows the loss, and something that has loss is more touching to us than something that doesn't have loss. But yeah, that doesn't seem to transfer into real life. And in fact, I mean, there's an interesting essay in the Chronicle of the Darien Leader book about this kind of thing, which is kind of really his subject in a way. But taking the Venus de Milo, the white cube sculptures of Alison Lapa, I mean, Alison's upper torso is precisely that of the Venus de Milo's. And I'd met her originally when we were doing the first group of eight sculptures, and she'd had a bad back, and also she didn't quite fit in with the concept of those original eight, which were about having a lost limb. But then, you know, we knew we wanted to do something together, and she got pregnant, and so it was the perfect opportunity. So I made one sculpture of her pregnant, and then 6 months later, one of her with her son. So it's a kind of pair that...
It's a Madonna and
yeah,
child.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Also, to take you back...
And it's kind of daring you to say, oh, isn't it wonderful, he has all his limbs. So it's kind of like, it's kind of making you, and then I think, what, you know...
And also think about life.
And life and continuation of life. And in fact, that whole show was about regeneration and generations, because the paintings are like the garden on a further generation. And then that was about regeneration. The blood vase with the orchid is about regeneration.
Yes, I wanted to talk about the blood vase
yeah.
and also the DNA.
And the DNA one, yeah.
So perhaps we could talk about the blood vase first.
Yeah, well, that's called Reincarnate. And in a sense, it's about the way that the kind of atoms and molecules that make up our bodies, when we die, will become something else. That the universe is a closed system, that it doesn't dissipate, it just becomes something else. And that we're made of carbon, and the atom carbon in us will become maybe CO2, which will be breathed in by a bird and become muscle power of its wing, which will make them, you know, the whole interconnectivity of creation, really. And also about our potential, it's kind of about when does a body become an object and not a living body. And so in that sculpture, the same amount of blood as in self, and then so then to turn it into an object, a vase, is kind of, it's about the fact we're all potential objects in a way. And then but then the flower coming out of the middle is about the kind of regeneration as well.
Also, I mean, people have taken that piece to be quite surreal. I mean, they've taken, read it, given it a kind of surrealist take, the kind of flower growing from the blood, the dropped blood or the dripped blood or the blood in some way nourishing the flower.
And also, yeah, exactly. And also, the orchid is a kind of flower that's very beautiful but almost ugly, and the vase is kind of ugly but almost beautiful. And so you've got this idea of beauty on the edge in some way.
Can we also talk about the DNA?
Yeah. And the DNA sculpture is called Self-Conscious, and the National Portrait Gallery has asked me to do a portrait of Sir John Sulston, who's the guy who is the head of the English team that mapped the human genome. That is something that I'm doing now that will come out in September. But meanwhile, obviously, I've been working with John a lot and talking about things. And I had this idea of extracting DNA from myself in some way and making it as pure as possible, and to see if that could be made visible. And I'd heard that you could kind of extract strands. And so working with him, there was a way that basically from semen, you then put that through 3 or 4 chemical processes and then dissolve it in other chemicals and blah blah blah, and you end up with this thread that is in fact pure human DNA preserved in 90% alcohol. And the fact that the thread is kind of crossways across the vase, it looks like kind of ray of light but it's amazing, because we're the kind of first generation that can know the instructions for building ourselves. So it's rather amazing.
It is extraordinary. And also, I think there's some kind of extraordinary statistics. DNA is very long, but
yeah,
it's
no, but also on
incredibly
each piece of,
thin as well, isn't
and also,
it?
But also, yeah, because that you strand is actually thousands of
yes,
strands.
Yes, thousands of strands. Yeah. So it's the length, but also yeah. it needs thousands in yeah. order to become visible for the width.
Absolutely. But there's also, on each piece of DNA, is like 330 million different information points, but the difference between you and me, or me and anyone else in the world, is a thousand. So really, it's about, it's actually a portrait of all of us, in a way. That it happens to be my DNA, but in fact, there's so little difference between... So it's again about kind of the similarity between people rather than the differences.
Is that something that's always interested you?
Yeah, it is, I think, and I think that runs in the group portrait of the marble sculpture as well, as the, you know, Peter Hull and I are, you know, very similar. What's the, you know, our bodies may be different, but we're people. So that kind of, but not in a kind of hippy-dippy way, but I do find that interesting.
Do you think that, again, I mean, this has been written, and I don't know whether this is your feeling, that some of this did come from your background? Your father is, in fact, a scientist.
Difficult for me to say that. I mean, I suppose, in a sense, I was familiar with the idea that of science and technology, and didn't think of it as something other. So maybe in that way. But it's difficult because I haven't got no comparison, because I've only lived my life.
Of course. But you do push your materials to their limits.
Yeah,
I mean,
definitely.
If you're working with lead, you'll absolutely push it to...
Well, I like things that are extreme. And I think that the other thing is I like things that communicate directly with people and communicate directly with people who have no knowledge of the history of art or art or anything. I mean, it's very important for me that things that work on an immediate democratic level, and that they have all the resonances and everything as well, but I'm not interested in art for art's sake, and I want to bring life into art and make it accessible.
Now, you said that you actually did study 17th century Dutch painting, and you also looked at work like Holbein, and the ambassadors, which you were, I think, quite fascinated by.
Yeah.
And that did that lead into working with the skull pieces?
Yeah, no, I mean, the what I like about the Holbein is you've got this sense of the parallel existence of two dimensions, but they're kind of slightly different. And you have these guys who are dressed up in their finery with all these objects of control and power and mapping, and yet in front of them is this other dimension that they have no control over at all, which is death. And so it was kind of interesting, and I thought of, in a way, inversing that. And so there's a steel column, and this skull turns around it. So you have the skull as the object that's in the real world, and our reflections as the distorted part. Because I think nowadays that's more like our lives than the opposite. We don't feel we control our lives. We feel that, you know, our relationship to our reflections is distorted.
So I think that's a very interesting point you've made, because that comes out in a lot of your work, and indeed in the piece we were just talking about just now with the DNA, because although we increasingly perhaps control our lives in one way, increasingly we feel out of control of some of the technology that could destroy
absolutely,
our lives,
yeah.
So that you're very much always engaging with these very fundamental questions. And I think the other thing that links your work, which I really love, is the idea of people can walk into a gallery and they can see your garden, they can see your paintings or let's say photographic works, and immediately appreciate them, love them or not, as the case may be, but they can relate to them as they can to the sculptures, because it's part of a whole genre that we all can have access to.
It's not obscure.
It's not an obscure... there isn't some kind of bread, although the work works on many different layers. You don't have to have those keys to all the layers to appreciate the work.
And maybe that obvious layer will bring you in, and then you will kind of look at the other layers.